5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the new Panic Room. It's the show other shows want to be, and the show that authors want to be on. The all-new Panic Room radio show is brought to you by HellboundBooks.com.
Well, good evening. It is 9:30 Central Time, still Central Time, I believe, and it is the new Panic Room episode 148, and that is that thanks to my daughter who keeps me fresh with all today's modern tunes and whatnot. That is actually The Panic Room by Aura, and I it could well become our new theme tune because I love the tune. Of course, it's quite fitting, I do believe. But so it is. It is Thursday night again. It honestly feels like we were just doing this last week, unless I guess you know time's sort of warping or something. But it is. It is scary. It's that time of year. Kids are not at school anymore, and it's all just like one long weekend, like an 11-week weekend for me. So I rarely know what day it is, to be honest with you. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do, because you know, I have missed her. I have missed her, and I think she's out of hibernation now. So we're going to bring Expedia. Evening, Xtina.
I'm good. I am.
Good. Well, enough about you. Let's talk about me now, shall we? Is it just me, or genuinely, does it just not seem like we were doing this yesterday?
It does, but what you're also saying about, you know, school being out and the kids and everything, and it seriously is just like one giant big blur, and, you know, Monday roll around and I'm like, oh, I don't want to work. It feels like
that is the killer. Yeah, you think, well, you know, because my cue is he's getting up, get the kids off to school, and then once the youngest is on the school bus, and I'm like, right, work time now, and it's just like, I don't make my alarm. I just wake up and I'm still waking up at 5:50 because I'm programmed to wake up at 5:50. But I don't have to get up. I just sort of lay in bed for a bit and think about getting snoozed a bit. Yeah. And say, shall I get up? And because you think I've got the whole day, and then suddenly it's 9:00 and it's bedtime. So they were, okay. So where does the day go? But nobody does the work for you. I've noticed it's still there.
It doesn't get magically done. I think it's sad that we don't get a summer vacation as well. We need to be off on for the summers as well. It's just not fair otherwise. But then again, who would pay the bills? So we must.
It's funny. I mean, my son and a little one, you know, she was, I think I told you, bless her, she actually booked time with me the other week to go to the beach, you know, because she gets it now, you know. She said, oh, Daddy, you're working hard. And I sat down and said, well, you know, Daddy works hard all the time, because if I didn't. My eldest gets it. He knows if I didn't work my ass off, then we wouldn't have any money. So she's getting there. She doesn't, and it's nice that, you know, she still wants to spend time with me, but she does understand. I think she's now getting a bit more materialistic. that you know, daddy working out means she can have the surfboard that she wanted, and she can, yeah, you know, go up to Splash Town, and we can do this and we can do that, and we'll have a takeaway when we want. And so she's getting it. She's going to be a proper little materialistic cow when she grows up. I can tell you that now.
You know, my son still doesn't get it. Just today, we had late dinner. I had to hurry up and, you know, clean up after dinner and then get up here. I only had a half an hour to go. And, you know, he wanted me to read with him. He likes it when I read with him. And, you know, his books he likes are so bloody boring. Well, I don't know if you could say boring, but
if they're boring, they're boring. You know, dull is dull at the end of the day.
Well, it's I told you he's reading, what is the guy's name who wrote Crime and Punishment? He's reading another book by this guy.
Was that Tolstoy or somebody?
I read a whole page. I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. None at all. So it's not for me. Yeah, but, you know, classic literature, whatever. So that, good on him. It's not even.
Some classic literature. I mean, to be fair, I think Tolstoy was probably dull even in those days. but now, I mean, some stuff stood the test of time. I mean, Dickens, you know, I still like. Although it's a bit, it can be a bit sloggy, can Dickens. I haven't read Dickens for a while, actually. But some of it's, some of it's okay, you know. Some of it you get through the, you know, the stodge. But Tolstoy. I think Tolstoy was always boring, to be honest. probably has me marked as an ignoramus. But I think it's one of those Dostoevsky.
That's who you read.
Well, whatever. I mean, they're all. I think they're all the same person, to be honest.
Yeah.
They're all the same part, same man. you know, I mean, and it's just. I think it's the sort of books that. It's like Shakespeare. But, you know, we had to learn Shakespeare at school. I think they do that here. Yeah. My son, he was Romeo and Juliet, funny enough, which is a great play about child abuse, which was nice. in the play, Juliet was only 14, so think on. All those schools, all those progressive schools in Mississippi, banning To Kill a Mockingbird because, you know, it had the word nigger in it, and completely and utterly missed the point. I mean, I actually studied To Kill a Mockingbird in English Lit back in high school. And it is a phenomenal book. I mean, it's such a great, great book with messages that resonate even today, which is probably why the asswipes in Mississippi decided they were going to ban it. You know, probably replace it with the Bible or something, you know, something, you know, true to life, a documentary. So, but it was like Shakespeare, you know, people are going, oh, Shakespeare. But it's not. I mean, it was probably all hip and groovy back in the 1600s, but... You know, we've moved on, really. You know, the language is just obviously dated.
See, that's the thing. Yeah, I would try to read along or whatever, and a whole page worth.
I mean, to be fair, any book that purports to be a comedy, where they have to explain the jokes in the margin is not a good comedy.
God. Yeah.
Sorry, it's not a good comedy book, be honest.
No.
So maybe they need to think about. In fact, I mean, there's so much. Look at. I mean, there's so much brilliant, brilliant modern literature. I mean, if you want, you know, comedy, comedy books. You know, something like Will Self or what's his name, Irving Welsh. You know, there's some brilliant, brilliant contemporary, and that means modern day. For Xtina there, contemporary authors, comedy authors that. People should be, instead of bloody Shakespeare, give me a break. Really? In fact, the reason that I was going to do sort of A-level English literature, and then I discovered that, you know, you would have to, like, Geoffrey Chaucer, which is like Shakespeare, and then, over 200 years earlier. It's like, it's barely recognisable as English. You know, and this is drivel. It's drivel. I don't want to be controversial, but it is, it's drivel.
Yeah, I don't. You know, I just, it's so hard to read. And, you know, I like to learn. I do like to learn when I'm reading. But at the same time, I don't want to have to pick up the book, you know, a dictionary or thesaurus every other word to be like, what is this? I don't even know what this is, you know. And
you're reading stuff like that. I mean, you're learning. I mean, yeah, okay, you have to look up what that word meant in, you know, 1602.
Right.
It doesn't really bear a lot of, you know, in those days, they didn't have the letter S, did they? They used Fs for S's and whatnot. It's just like, we have moved on, people.
Yeah.
Really, we have moved on.
I have to give my kid credit, though, for the, you know, reading what he is reading. And the fact that he does look at the footnotes and everything, I think that's cool, you know.
Do not take anything away from the kid. I mean, he's reading. The fact that he's reading and he's got his nose pressed up against, you know, his phone screen or computer screen 24/7, is credit to him, you know. Reading will become a dying art, you know, and good on him for that. He just needs to read something better, in my opinion.
I do too.
I mean, if you, I tell you something, I mean, you know, if you, great works of fiction, obviously any of Donald Trump's speeches, which comedy as well, I mean, it is funny. The Mueller report is going to make fantastic reading. You know, so there's some good contemporary literature right there.
It's true.
Awkward silence.
Yeah.
I'm beginning to think you're a secret Trump supporter, Xtina, to be honest.
I'm not. I try not to get political. I really do try, so
why?
Yeah. Why? I have no I don't have any good reason.
I don't know. I don't have an opinion. I'm not allowed opinions, mate. So, anyhow, moving swiftly along, Xtina. We do have a show this evening, and what a show it is! What have we got for our listener this evening?
I'm very excited tonight in the Panic Room. We have the great grandnephew of Bram Stoker and international best-selling co-author of Dracula the Undead, the official Stoker family-endorsed sequel to Dracula, Dacre Stoker. Woo! I'm excited.
No, I wasn't introducing. I just wanted to know what's on.
I know, but I'm excited.
I'm excited as well. It's like having horror literature royalty on the show. Beyond excited.
Yes.
We need a virtual. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll bring Dacre on. I'm going to let you introduce him, obviously. Since you booked him, because I have no part in that whatsoever. I turn up at sort of 9:10, put my headphones on, and away we go. So this is all. if it wasn't for you, Xtina, nothing would happen. Nothing. It could just be me.
Yeah.
Even then, probably not even that. I probably wouldn't even make it, to be honest. I'd just be having a nap or watching TV. We'll talk about TV a little bit later. We caught a couple of decent shows this past week or so. So we can talk about telly. I can talk about the telly. But, okay, I'm going to let you introduce our first and only guest.
Okay, here we go. The international best-selling co-author of Dracula the Undead, Dacre Stoker.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Hello, you're there. How are you this evening, sir?
I'm very well. I'm sitting comfortably in South Carolina, listening to some very interesting conversation up to this point.
Oh, so you're listening to a different show then?
it must have been. I was listening to the debates on television, and I quickly had to run in here catch the tail end of what you were saying.
Ah, right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's an absolute, it's a privilege and an honour. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
It's South Carolina. What time is it over? I've been over here now 9 years. I'm still struggling with living in a country with more than one time zone. What time is it over there? I don't even know where it is in relation to Texas, to be honest.
Wow.
Well, it's pretty far east from Texas. It's 10:49, and it's not too far from Atlanta.
Yeah, you're
right.
I'm in Tennessee, so yeah, you're not terribly far.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think.
Where are you in Tennessee?
Time.
Are you allowed to tell where you are?
Sure, I'm right up at the top of the Virginia-Tennessee border thing or whatever. Bristol.
Near Bristol.
Yeah,
oh,
Bristol.
Yeah.
That's
actually
yeah,
I do a lot of fly fishing up in that area.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's so pretty here. It really is.
Just
going to the store or going, you know, wherever. I'm just the whole time I'm staring out the window, thinking it is so pretty here. So.
Yeah, no, it's a nice part of the country. I moved from Canada to come here to escape the winters. Plus, my wife, who was a local, had something to do with it. But I quite enjoy missing the winters, although the summers are a little tough to take, but we just bear with it, as I'm sure you do in Texas.
Oh, my goodness me, yes.
You know. Yeah.
Well, imagine, I came from Yorkshire, Northern England. So it was England, and then, you know, obviously England is known for being rainy and a bit cold. I mean, it was like Yorkshire is pretty good. And there's a saying in England, it's grim up north. And to go from the Yorkshire climate, which if it gets into the early 70s in Yorkshire, that's a beach day. I mean, it's literally, people
wow.
are sitting on the beach. Here, people have got their hats and coats on. and we left, like it was the end of July, sort of 9 years ago now. And we left from Manchester Airport, and of course it was raining and it was cold, it was miserable. And we flew and got off the plane in Houston, and it was like stepping into an oven. It was like, I think it was like 103, I think, when we, so we went from like, what? I nearly got straight back on the plane. I'm like, no. But it does. We actually get heat warnings here. You know, you get heat advisory warnings. It just says it's going to be hot. Don't go out. You know, if you go out, you will die. Just stay in. But I don't think you get used to the heat. You just learn how to manage it. You just learn when you can go out and when to just stay in and stay by your air conditioning.
No, it's true. I spent many years in Florida, and you never get used to that heat. And I still, you know, if somebody mentions the Florida heat, I'm like, curse it.
Florida is and then some, isn't it? Because the humidity in Florida is crippling. I hear. Yeah.
I remember just walking out the door and feeling like you couldn't breathe. The air was just sucked out of you. It was so bloody hot. So, you know, I mean, I don't know how hot we're, because I haven't been in this area yet for a summer, so I'm not quite sure how hot we do get here. You know, it can't be anywhere near what Florida was, so I'm excited. And
good.
Yeah, plus,
good,
plus
we're pleased for you.
Yeah, and we get good winters. It snowed last year. That was like super cool. You know, I had not seen snow in quite a while, so that was pretty cool.
Awesome.
I mean, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure Baker doesn't miss it, you know, being from Canada. But
I don't miss not seeing snow.
No,
we've had a little bit of it. We've had some freak snows down here in South Carolina, but people usually turn to me and ask, "What do we do now?" Because I'm a local resident expert, and I just wait for it to go away. They don't have any snow plows; they just wait for it to go away.
Yeah, do you know Texas is the same? We I think it was last year. It literally snowed for a day, and it was a fair covering, and they closed the sky. Everything just closed. It's just closed, Texas. I don't know, what is this white snow? What is this? And they were just frightened of it. And like you said, because it happens so infrequently, they're just not prepared. And it's just like, just sit and watch it go. Hopefully it'll go away. And it literally lasted a day, and that was it. That was gone. So, Dago,
let's talk about Dracula, not the weather, because I didn't write any books on the weather. Let's talk Dracula here, folks.
I was about to get to it, because again, being a Brit, you know, the weather is like the number one topic there. But I mean, Dracula, I mean, you obviously come from quite a pedigree.
Yep. it's been an interesting one. I was going to ask you, in your time in Yorkshire, have you spent any time in Whitby?
I absolutely. Funny enough, my first honeymoon was in Whitby, and I remember I was on a school trip, obviously before my honeymoon, and we stayed not far from Whitby Abbey, which is where in the book Dracula, where Dracula actually came to the UK, and we sat up all night scaring ourselves silly about with Dracula stories. But have you been to you must have been to Whitby yourself, yeah?
Well, I've been there quite a few times. I mean that's I think for your listeners the key thing is that Bram Stoker, my great granduncle, was only visited Whitby one time. He was there for 3 weeks in summers in 1890, and he was so taken by the area, obviously this gorgeous ruins of this Whitby Abbey that goes mm-hmm. back to, you know, the year 1000, and you know, so much great history with that, and a wonderful church that's up there. But it wasn't just those two things. Bram had started writing Dracula in 1890, and by the time he got to Whitby in the summer, he was obviously looking for some place for the entry point or the count to arrive. And because as you know, I'm sure all your listeners know, if they haven't read the book, they understand the story. The count comes from Transylvania, but he has to be in these crates of soil, so he has to be at the mercy of, you know, a shipping agent, and then these crates have to then make their way to London. But obviously he arrives into a port, and what Bram did, and what he has done so well in not just his book Dracula, but the others he's written, he makes good friends with the local Coast Guard, the local fishermen, the local folks who know the stories of the area. And then he adapts the real stories of the area into his fictional stories. And so he found the records in the Coast Guard reports of a ship, the Dmitri, that was a Russian schooner that had some mysterious wreck on the Tate Hill Sands in this protected sort of harbor. And he quickly jumped at that, and that's what I need. And so he's just switched some of the factors around, changed the years a little bit, but he had the ship, the Demeter, arrive with the count on it in the crate, and then he jumped out of the crate as a dog. And as you would know, James, he runs up 199 steps, and he goes up to the
church. As well.
And that's where, you know, that's where not just that scene, but he's got all chapters 6, 7, and 8 in this wonderful town. So I go there on a regular basis. I've got a friend that runs the Tomorrow's Ghost Festival there. They bring in goth music, people in costumes. I give lectures. Mm-hmm. This past April, I was actually there with some of the wonderful actresses that acted in the Dracula movies in the Hammer film days.
And so we
all did panels together and signed things. Carolyn Monroe, Pauline Pert, Martine Beswick. It was wonderful. And of course, people come in droves in the wonderful costumes, and they really sort of live that, you know, for that weekend. They just get all dressed up in different outfits and all over the town, going into the bars. And it was wonderful. So I don't know if you miss Whitby, but it's fun to get back to, and I do enjoy going there. It's probably been about 7 or 8 times now.
Oh, yeah, it's one of my favorite places. I say I have happy memories from my childhood when we said we went on the school trip, and we used to, because we live probably, you know, 2-hour drive from Whitby, and I have to say, for next time you go back, if you haven't been, probably the best fish and chip shop in Yorkshire is the Magpie. Which is in Whitby. The best cod and chips on the planet ever. We used to go, because I lived in York for quite some time, and we used to drive from York to Whitby just to go to the Magpie Fish and Chip Shop, or restaurant.
There's great debate, isn't there? Your listeners would love this, because the Magpie is the place that gets all the great press, but when you get there, the locals will say, "Well, yeah, the Magpie, they get all the press, but it's really good over here, too." There must be every restaurant in Whitby claims the best, because it's fresh, it's wonderful, and the atmosphere is great. You just have to watch out for the seagulls coming down to try to take your little pieces of the chips.
Yes, they are. The seagulls are vicious. They will. They literally, if you walking on the, again, this is a British thing, you'd have your chips in, used to be old newspaper when I was a kid, and you're walking on the seafront, and the seagulls would dive bomb you and steal your chips.
They do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. absolutely fearless. So it's pretty big. And they're big. You don't realize how big those birds are until they're on top of you stealing your food.
Yeah, and they've got signs now posted, because it really is a problem for the uninitiated tourists, you know, because they get scared to death with these. It's a bit of like an Alfred Hitchcock movie, you know, these birds dive on you, and all you've done is got an ice cream sundae, or you've got fish and chips, but the birds seem to want it more than you do.
Oh, yeah. The problem is that, they put the signs up, but the birds just ignore them.
The birds do, yeah. They haven't learned to read there yet.
I know. They should. They should. They need an education program. But you mentioned, I grew up on the Hammer Horror films, and that was my Saturday night was Hammer Horror. And I have to ask, who is your favorite? I'm guessing you're going to say Christopher Lee, but I'm going to ask, who is your favorite screen Dracula?
Well, I love Christopher Lee, but there's three of them, because, you know, this era of Dracula on film spans, you know, over 100 years. I mean, 120 some odd years. So I guess it's an easy way out, but I've got to give credit. Bela Lugosi at the beginning, he on both on stage and then in the 31 Todd Browning film, he was wonderful with this, you know, the lack of sophistication of the cameras and the special effects. He was great for establishing the role. But Christopher Lee, I agree, took it to a whole nother level. His presence, his looks, he was incredible. And I also I admire that man, what he's done off the screen as well. What an amazing person all around. And then his other roles he's played. But then in the modern era, Gary Oldman did one heck of a job in the 92 Coppola film. But he had the advantage of lots of extra costumes and more sophistication. So those three guys, in their own way, you can't really compare them. It's like sort of comparing football teams from different decades. You know, the fitness was different, the equipment different. And I think those three guys, I put them on a pedestal, because those are my big three.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. So again, Bela Lugosi, that's probably, I've seen some of those movies, and he did. He brought, I think he had that look. I guess Christopher Lee was the same. He had that look without the makeup.
Yeah, that's true. He was more basic, Lugosi was. But one of the coolest things that I know about Lugosi, and maybe not all your listeners know this, he didn't speak English very well at all at the beginning when he was on stage. All of his lines were phonetic, so he would recite his lines, and it would be all phonetically, and that's why it was sort of, you know, welcome to my house, enter freely. It made it sound even more scary and sort of wrote Transylvanian or something, of the way of his speech pattern. It was genuine, the difficulty he had speaking, and that made it, you know, really,
wow,
really eerie.
I did not know that. I thought that was him method acting, but that was him struggling with English. Christopher Lee didn't even really try with an accent. Did he? He was Christopher Lee.
He was perfect. He
for me, he was like Roger Moore in James Bond. You know, he brought that level of sort of more upmarket, the sophistication, rather than, I mean, Sean Connery was sort of a more gritty, I guess. But yeah,
well,
I don't know how many.
When you analyze how these vampires have become more, I guess we say human-like. You know. It's, of course, I go to a lot of academic conferences and fan conferences, film things, and people sort of look at this and say, you know, we know that Bram Stoker didn't invent vampires. You know, there was John Polidori, who wrote The Vampire, and there was Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, and there was Malcolm Reimer it'll come back to me. But, you know, these three books have been written prior to Bram, and all those vampires were a little bit different. Varney the Vampire, that's the one. And as these vampires sort of emerged in literature, Bram Stoker's Dracula in 1897 was not the sexy Eastern European Bela Lugosi. He was not at all. He was a, you know, this kind of, you know, grotesque kind of count, and he didn't come to London, but he wasn't this, you know, really hot guy that was picking up women. That was a specific tactic that the people on stage, Hamilton Dean and John Balderston, that created the first stage plays, they needed a handsome guy on stage. They needed a guy in a dinner jacket, and they, that's how, why Lugosi played that role so well. He needed a leading man who was, you know, hot and heavy. If they had put this ugly, gross revenant, I mean, that's like zombies from today would be what Bram's Dracula is like. And then, of course, they kept emerging to, you know, Frank Langella, Jack Palance, all these other Dracula actors, and my God. And then we get to Anne Rice when she gets involved in these, and Stephen King. Now, Stephen King did revert back to having a in Salem Plot.
He went back to the sort of the Nosferatu sort of style, didn't he?
He did, but in between there, you had Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise, two of the hottest stars in Hollywood, you know, attracting women. And then, of course, Vampire Diaries and True Blood,
Buffy,
all these other things. Just imagine how they've all evolved. But it really did start with Lugosi and Lee kind of setting the tone, and then creative directors and screenwriters and casting directors. They sure had their way with it, but they did a good job because they've captivated everybody.
And then, of course, you had, I'm going to mention it again, Twilight, that really pushed it to sparkly vampires. Twilight?
What was that?
Absolutely, yeah, exactly.
No,
I have to ask, I mean, what was your take? Sparkly vampires, really?
No, listen, it's so easy. Christine, I don't know if you do this too. I mean, it's so easy. Everybody loves to diss Stephanie Meyer and Twilight because they did take the vampires to essentially create the genre of paranormal romance. They moved away from what Stephen King and Anne Rice and Bram Stoker and others had created. But my gosh, she got a lot of people reading and buying books that had to do with a version of vampire. Got a lot of people into theaters. My God, she, you know, really established or reestablished the vampire in, you know, literature and theater while we were all waiting to, you know, catch up and get really good again. So it's like somebody raised the bar, even though we're not jumping over that same bar, we're doing something different. But I hand it to her creativity. That was kind of cool. It's not my thing, but it is interesting, and I take my hat off to her ingenuity.
I was a Twilight fan. I really was. I did have to, you know, pause and wonder why they're sparkly and stuff. But I really like Twilight, of course.
Well, I saw the movies, that courtesy of my, because I have a young daughter, and I sat through all of those films. I enjoyed for what they were. I enjoyed the Harry Potter films, for goodness sake. You know, the great bit of escape. And I like that sort of stuff sometimes. You know, sometimes, and it was great. Yeah. I sat and watched that. And, you know, like as you said, Dave, I mean, it appealed to the market that it was meant to appeal to, which was the, you know, the tweens, basically. Hence, they were sparkly, and the werewolves were, you know, buff, fit, shirtless young men, which were, you know, brilliant.
Yeah,
but,
was hot.
Well, yeah.
I got to tell you guys something funny. I was very high in my horse. I was 2009 flying back from launching Dracula the Undead on a tour in Italy, France, Spain, and I was like on top of the world, flying home to America, you know, sort of ready to, you know, sort of face the press back here. It was great. I was sitting in a plane next to this wonderful old lady, and I was, you know, pretty proud of, you know, what I've been doing. She said, what have you been doing, young man, and all this? I said, well, I'm an author, just been launching a book. Oh, tell me about it. And I say, well, it's about vampires. I don't want to scare you. Oh, you can't scare me. I've read all the Twilight books. I love them. She was an 80-year-old grandmother.
Oh.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, listen, Stephanie Meyer appealed to the, you know, 13-year-olds to 80-year-olds and everybody in between.
Yeah.
And boy, did she has a good track record for selling books. I got to give her that.
Yeah.
You can't knock that. You cannot knock that. Right. So, although, yeah, I say the books. I mean, I think it was the third movie that was. Was that the one where they were on the honeymoon? And the first hour of that with my 9-year-old daughter, and it was like I just wanted to crawl under the couch, to be honest. I don't need to be watching this, to be honest. Too many questions were coming my way.
So
let's watch SpongeBob. No, I want to watch. What are they doing now? Oh, seriously.
Mm.
But hey,
No, I was going to make a joke and say, you know, when we're talking about Dracula, I saw him on an episode of Buffy. It was a really good episode. So.
Oh, he turned up on Buffy. Excellent.
He did. It was like season 6, I think it was. And you know how she kills vampires, but no, she did not kill Dracula. He was way too powerful. But so I thought that was kind of cool. You know, there were still.
He gets cameo appearances in all kinds of things. Did either of you watch the Penny Dreadful that was on the Showtime? And it ran its course, and now they're beginning to come back again with Timothy Dalton.
I saw the first couple of those, which were okay. I mean, did Dracula pop up in there as well?
He did. I mean, what their whole concept was, they took out. They took a look at the classic horror stories. So they had the Dr. Frankenstein, they had Dorian Gray, and sort of this take on a sort of the presence of a Dracula creature for about, I don't know, a season. And he didn't show up until season 2. But what was interesting, guys, is much like the book Dracula, the character, the Count, he's only on about 20% of the pages, but he's present in everybody's mind all the time. And they did the same thing in Penny Dreadful, in that they sort of had him as this sort of off somewhere in the distance, and they're wondering, oh, what is doing this? What's killing people? What's biting the neck? And all these other things. And it's not center, front and center until they get into the, I think it's season 2, and then they actually sort of present him, which was a little anticlimactic. But it just does show that, done properly, his presence is incredible. And if you overdo it, it's too easy for people to sort of go, okay, that's the guy we know. You know, he's there. He's going to put it in his hand. He's going to mesmerize you. He's going to hypnotize you, drink your blood. But if you don't know exactly what he's up to, he's more scary. If he's just sort of the potential for him to do something, because he's got so many powers. But there's always new things that people are inventing. You know, that he doesn't break down doors. He has to be invited in, but he can still sort of to control your mind and get in if he tricks you into inviting him in. That sort of thing.
And I think our imagination is scarier anyway. I mean, I think that what we conjure up in our own imaginations, you know, can be so much scarier than anything that's out there.
I think, unfortunately, certainly with movies, and I think there's a lot of authors these days, well, certainly pick on the movies. I think because the audience just wants it in your face and boom, literally ramming down. That sense of all pervading. I mean, there are some movies that get, like Hereditary, I think, did manage to pull it off, where, as Dacre said, you know, instead of it being, you know, bang, 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 you know, it's just horror and blood and, you know, it's just through the whole thing. It's just there, and it's in your mind, and it seeps into it. And that's the sort of movie or sort of book that stays in your head. I prefer that. You just don't really see much of that these days.
It takes a bold author or a bold screenwriter to withhold the spoon feeding. You know, don't spoon feed your audience or your readers. Sort of make them work for it. Now, you know, it's interesting, Xtina, to see what you say about this as an author, because your editors, your publishers, like, get on with it. You know, get to it in the second chapter. You've got to, you know, captivate them. Otherwise, people be bored and put it down, because people nowadays are so used to, you know, watching television, and you've got messages coming at you underneath the screen, on top of the corner of the screen, all these. Yeah. And so when you read books, you want to get right to it. But the really good ones are the ones that are suggestive and make you think and don't present right away. It's there. And those are the ones you remember the most. But of course, a book like that gets sold to a film studio and they go ruin it because they've got their formula. they've got the three act play that they've got to conform to. And then there goes all your hard work at stimulating the imagination.
I guess it pops into my head. I think probably one of the most of the contemporary books that did that the best was The Exorcist, because really nothing insidious really started happening till almost halfway through the book.
Yeah.
I do remember.
You knew it was the build-up, and the build-up was just phenomenal. And it's very rare I read a book more than once, because obviously I know what's going to happen. Exorcist, I've read it a couple of times, and each time it just sticks in your head incredibly well.
Well, you sort of know, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but with The Exorcist, we've grown up knowing what the devil is. We don't know exactly what it is or what its complete power, but we have a pretty good idea of what it is. So that's kind of sitting out there. As you read through the story, you know that this incredible, powerful demon, you know, darkness, everything about bad is out there, and we're just waiting for it to appear. And in a strange way, that's one reason why I think Bram Stoker did such a good job. He didn't invent a vampire. He grabbed onto the same thing that The Exorcist did, an existing, in this case, a superstition, very much like the devil, of vampires that were, you know, sort of going around Europe in the 16 and 1700s, which was really the plague, unexplained killing of people, and they had no idea about germ theory or contagious diseases being passed on. They thought it was vampires that were coming out of the grave and taking the life of the living, which was really somebody got the next disease. So when you tap into an existing nerve that exists in your readership, in your society, in your culture, like Bram did with vampires, it was easy to ignite that flame, like The Exorcist and the devil. You just had to play it right to not bring it out right at the beginning. What do you guys think about that theory?
I think it's about tapping into the, you know, zeitgeist of the moment, which Dracula, I mean, the fact that it's still popular, you know, all these years on. I mean, I'd like to think, like, The Exorcist, you know, in 100 years' time, people will be debating The Exorcist in the same sort of way, you know, that I think the very best, you know, movies, the very best books do that, you know, they take that element of truth. It's not, you know, it's just, how can I word it? There's just that element of belief, just enough in it for you to get into your brain and think that perhaps, you know, as Dacre said, you know, back in those days, you know, the idea of vampires, because they didn't know about germs, they didn't know about that, was perfectly plausible. What else could it be? It's things rising from the grave and sucking the life out, because they'd see people die from these horrible diseases and it would just drain the life from them, which is what would have given rise to, to the myths. And, yeah, I mean,
Bram
Stoker, obviously, like you say, obviously a very, very clever man, tapped right into that. And I like, you know, what you said about him, you know, integrating the sort of the subplots and the small, you know, the elements of the story into, you know, the real life, into the
real story. I was recently in London this past January. I don't know if either of you heard this. The London Library discovered that they knew that Bram did his research there, or a lot of it, not all of it. He did some at the British Museum Library. But the London Library, they found the card that the writer Hall Caine had nominated Bram to become a member there. And they contacted me. They found 28 of the books that Bram listed at the end of his Dracula notes that are now sitting in a museum in Philadelphia. Like a good student, Bram listed all of his resources, and he listed his book. And they found them sitting in the library. But not only that, they found that he had done some little naughty things. He wrote with pencil in the margins of some of the books and made lots of little notes.
Oh, wow.
What's really cool is, I was there with a friend of mine, Robert 18 Bassang, who is one of the best well-known Dracula scholars in the world, to look at what do those notes mean, what those little X's and marks and mems and things mean. And we sort of started to create a theory of, you know, what he underlined obviously made its way into Dracula. So we were comparing this, something from a certain book, and you know what we found? Back in those days, there was a book by a certain medical doctor, last name Mayo, that had a book about popular superstitions. But he was actually a doctor who was bringing credibility to such superstitions as trance, you know, ESP, mesmerism, mm-hmm. and he had a whole chapter on vampirism.
Oh,
and as
wow.
I read through this chapter and saw all these little marks, this doctor was sort of analyzing vampirism as it's potentially true. So I can't
neat.
Give, I mean, Bram didn't just invent this idea, as you just said, James, to take mm-hmm. real things. He found real things that the medical community and the, we'll call it pseudoscience community, were beginning to recognize. Spiritualism, as you both know, was huge in the Victorian era.
Oh, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Mark Twain and all these, everybody believing, and Conan Doyle believing that the body goes mm-hmm. on, and all these seances. Well, this was the time, this is not too far removed from what mm-hmm. people were doing, Houdini trying to debunk uh-huh. all these people who were seancing. Well, Bram was simply going a little step further with looking at vampirism. And of course, he's got this, and he's identified this off in Eastern Europe. But what does he really do that's awesome is he brings this guy and this horrifying superstition that people are beginning to think is possibly real to Whitby and then into London, buying up property, three properties in London. So he's delivering the horror to the doorstep of what people are already thinking is possibly real and true.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is, I guess, is the root of the success of the book, I guess, because it was just, you know, and I read Dracula many years ago, and you know, a lot of it, you know, it does stick, and it does it just gives you, even, you know, allowing for the, you know, the older, we mentioned at the beginning of the show, you know, the older style language, the Gothic language. It still gets, it's one of those that just gets into the back of your head, and it's just that, yeah, this could happen, you know. It's just that enough doubt. I must admit, I remember reading Frankenstein, or trying to read Frankenstein. It just didn't grab me in the same way. I mean, it's just a personal thing. It just didn't grab me in the same way Dracula did.
Let me do something. I'm going to deviate a little bit from something. Give you some, because you just brought up something, James, that I can't not read this to you. There is in the last couple of years, a friend of mine, a Dutch-German guy, he found an early draft of Dracula that had been published in Sweden in a newspaper and then published in Iceland in a newspaper before they got published in a book. That was actually laws of the day. You had to serialize your novel if you were not a native of that country. So Bram mm-hmm. was not a native, obviously, of Sweden or Iceland. Same in the U.S. They had to put it mm-hmm. in the newspaper before you could get a copyright to publish.
Oh, wow.
And this early draft of Dracula had this preface that nobody has ever seen before, because the preface of the 1897 Dracula that we've all come to know is the version that was put on stage and made the movies. This earlier draft is much more violent, much more sexual, much more complex. And it's obviously, as I've analyzed the heck out of it, it's a rough draft. But what I want to read to you and the listeners, which just reeks of Bram convincing us it was real. And it's actually the motivation for J.D. Barker and I to write Dracul. So let me read this to you. It's only about two and a half minutes long, but I think at this stage in our show tonight, it would make a lot of sense and resonate. And I'd love to hear what you two think after I finish reading this. So can I start that now?
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
Okay, here we go. The reader of this story will very soon understand how the elements outlined in these pages have been gradually drawn together to make a logical whole. Apart from excising minor details, which I consider unnecessary, I have let the people involved relate their experiences in their own way,
but for obvious reasons, I have changed the names of the people and the places concerned. In all other respects, I have left the manuscript unaltered in deference to the wishes of those who have considered it their duty to present it before the eyes of the public. I am quite convinced that there is no doubt whatever that the events here described really took place, however unbelievable and incomprehensible they might appear at first sight, and I am further convinced that they must always remain to some extent incomprehensible. Although continuing research in psychology and natural sciences may, in years to come, give logical explanations of such strange happenings which at present neither scientists nor the secret police can understand, I state again that this mysterious tragedy, which is here described, is completely true in all its external respects, though naturally I've reached a different conclusion on certain points than those involved in the story. But the events are incontrovertible, and so many people know of them that they cannot be denied. This series of crimes has not yet passed from the memory, a series of crimes which appear to have originated from the same source, and which at the same time created as much repugnancy in people everywhere as the murders of Jack the Ripper, which came into the story a little later. Various people's minds will go back to the remarkable group of foreigners who for many seasons together played a dazzling part in the life of the aristocracy here in London, and some will remember that one of them disappeared suddenly without apparent reason, leaving no trace. All the people who have willingly or unwillingly played a part in this remarkable story are known generally and well respected. Both Jonathan Harker and his wife, who is a woman of character, and Dr. Seward are my friends and have been for many years. I have never doubted that they were telling the truth. And the highly respected scientist who appears here under a pseudonym will also be too famous all over the educated world for his real name, which I have not desired to specify, to be hidden from people, least of all those who had from experience learnt to value and respect his genius and accomplishments, though they adhere to his views on life no more than I. But in our times it ought to be clear to all serious thinking men that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Bram Stoker, 1898.
Wow.
Wow.
How about that? I believe it now.
I'm convinced.
And obviously, again, you think back to the people of the day when they didn't have internet and TV, etc. You know that they would read that in the paper. It puts me in mind of the Orson Welles War of the Worlds thing.
War of the Worlds.
They create, because that went on the radio, that was suddenly, it was a different medium. And that you can imagine if that was reading was done on the radio, had the technology been there at the time, it would have created a similar amount of panic.
Yeah.
Well, and this, folks, I've just written, imagine both of you are sitting in a room with me and I'm pitching to you, Here's my story. And the next thing I'm going to say is, what if Bram Stoker wrote Dracula as a warning to the world that vampires are real?
Ooh, I guess so.
Because this is exactly what I did with J.D. I said, J.D., here's the whole concept. And he goes, holy, well, I can't say exactly what he said. He said, where is this? Where does this preface come from? I said, well, this is the original one. And so we dug into it, did some research, and we both believe, James, exactly what you just said, that the reason Bram had to edit this is that his editor, Otto Kalman, at Archibald Constable, said, nope, London is not ready for this. We create absolute panic. People would go crazy. So you've got to edit this thing down. And so the very first paragraph, the first four sentences, is all that was left from this preface in the 1897 version of Dracula. And the story is obviously different than what ended up in Sweden and Iceland. But it is actually sold, translated back to English, as a book called Powers of Darkness that I wrote the introduction to. But back to the task at hand. J.D. and I took this preface that I just read, and the premise
that Dracula was written as if the story was real. And if Bram had a good reason to believe they were real, what would it be?
Mm-hmm.
And what my research has told me, and this is the part where reality and fiction kind of blend in, and I'll tell you what is true and what's not. And the true part is, Bram was one of seven children, and he was very ill for the first 7 years of his life, and he was not expected to live. And those 7 years, he was almost an invalid. And during those 7 years, he was bloodlet by one of his uncles, who was a famous bloodletting doctor.
Ah.
During that time, bloodletting was pretty horrific. It was either leeching or cutting. And I managed to find one of the treatises of his uncle, Edward Alexander Stoker, who described in detail what it was like to bloodlet a child who came from a fairly healthy family, which would be different than, you know, some kid off the street. Some are more robust, even though they're ill. But imagine this, listeners of the Panic Room, that the child, the amount of blood that was taken out of a child was not measured in cc's or ounces. It was simply enough to make the child pass out. And then they'd take the leech off. And then to rehydrate the child, they'd give a mixture of oil and claret, which is red wine. The alcohol would cleanse the body. You take out a lot of the blood, and then you're putting back in alcohol. You're going to have a kid who's drunk for about 2 days until his body can regenerate.
Yeah.
So
Imagine
young Bram Stoker for 7 years, sickly, up in the third floor of his room, has a little bell to ring when he's having a hard time breathing and suffering fever, and they come up and either give him a little bit of water to drink or bloodlet him. Imagine the kind of trauma that this poor kid would grow up with.
Wow. I can't even imagine, I mean, the effect that would have on a child's mind.
So everything I just told you there was true. Okay, that is true. What JD and I did, I start thinking, because my background is in coaching athletics, and I actually coached the Canadian team at the Olympic Games in 88. It was like, well, this is strange. Bram Stoker, at the age of seven, had this miraculous recovery. This is true. He went on to Trinity College in Dublin and became a champion athlete in athletics, gymnastics, rugby, rowing. He became the big stud. So how do you go from a seven-year bloodletted invalid to become this massive stud at the age of 17, 18? And my thinking, I mean, this is when
you become a vampire.
The writers, you get some vampire blood. I mean, what else could you get possibly have? I mean, in my day, it would be Lance Armstrong getting steroids or something, but in these days, Bram Stoker getting some vampire blood, okay? So that's the beginning of the story. And, Xtina, I know you write, and you get these what-if moments yourself, and that's what we went through. We said, okay, if Bram had some vampire blood in him that gave him this power, obviously, you got to pay the piper at some time, and the vampires are going to come and want something in return. And that's when you know you're in deep trouble, and you're going to have to do something to warn the world. And if you went to the police station and say, excuse me, there's a vampire down the street, you know, they're going to throw you into an asylum. But in Bram Stoker's way, you write a book, and you warn the world through your writing. And that's the basics, how JD and I got into this sort of three-year process to research and write this book that just came out last year. So there we go.
Wow. So, okay. I mean, I want a copy of it signed. Obviously, I want a copy of this book. Tell us. So the premise is that it was all real. Yeah.
The premise is that it's real, and we need to make a realistic story on how it could possibly be real. How is he introduced to this whole concept? And it's I don't want to give too much away.
Of course, yeah.
But there are people in the family, and there is a nanny in the family, and there are associates that they meet that sort of have some interesting backgrounds they're not really sure about. And just as we chatted at the beginning of the show, I want to give a lot of background, let people know about the family. And it's about a third into the book you begin to think something's a little off with one or two of these people. And then by the halfway point, you know there's a really big deal. But what we did was we studied the original draft of Dracula. We actually, J.D. talked his way into going out to Seattle, Washington, to look at the latest version of Dracula, which is in a typed form. It's called a typescript. So Paul Allen, the gentleman that was a co-founder of Microsoft,
mm-hmm.
he actually is a major collector of things, and he purchased the Dracula typescript for just under $1 million about 10 years ago. So we hunted
wow.
that down and got an invitation to come out and analyze it. And one of the things we found was that the first 101 pages were missing. And so was that original preface I read you. Where did they go?
Uh-huh.
So I've been looking at scholarly reports and different biographies. Some of the people I respect, and I've seen some consistency, they think that obviously it was edited out because of length. But then we found that when Bram died, his widow published a portion of those 101 pages in a short story called Dracula's Guest. And when I cross-referenced all the events in that 17-page short story, which is basically a Jonathan Harker character in Munich,
mm-hmm.
he's got a day off, and he goes out to the countryside in a carriage, and he gets into a little, let's say, some shenanigans in a graveyard with a wolf, as you can imagine what's going on there.
Yeah, as you do.
Because the next day he's supposed to get on the train to go to Transylvania. All that was cut out. And
wow.
so what I did was, with JD's help, we looked into the typescript and found exact references to things that happened in the short story Dracula's Guest that was in the typescript but had been crossed out. Because obviously if you edit something out, you've got to go through the rest of the manuscript to make sure you don't leave things hanging that you
yeah.
took out.
Right.
And
yeah.
so what we did with this book, Dracul, was we lined up the end of our story with the original beginning, which was Dracula's Guest in Munich.
Ah.
So the book dovetails perfectly with what Bram originally started. So again, since we've written the story as a warning to the world, the sequence of events bring you right up to all those characters in the novel Dracula being real people, just like Bram said in his preface, real people.
Right.
Jonathan Harker is a friend of mine. His wife's a woman of character, Dr. Seward. So all these people were known to Bram, and they went off on this adventure to try to save the world and stop this guy. This guy, Count Dracula.
Oh, wow. I'm fascinated. Absolutely.
Yeah. I was going to say, Zaker, I want to hear more. Do you have a reading for us?
I do. Let me get this organized because I'm going to go. Obviously, you've got a book of almost 500 pages. What do you do and read? But I think what I've done is I've kind of framed this for you guys by giving how the book started, and probably one of the most mysterious characters, other than the vampire Count Dracula, was this nanny, and the nanny really was the long-term nanny of the family. She was very mysterious where she came from. She lived with them until the day she died. At Trinity College in Dublin, we've got pictures of her, and we also found out that Thornley, Bram's oldest brother, kept a locket of her hair all his life, and it's now in the Trinity College archives. So there's some interesting, weird stuff going on with Nana Ellen Crone. So this is what I'm going to read to you and the listeners tonight. It's probably about 3 minutes long or so, and it'll give you guys a flavor of how we've decided to frame this story and who some of these weird characters are. So here we go. I have often reflected on the beauty of Ellen Crone. At the age of 7, I had no such thoughts, but as an adult, I cannot deny her allure. Her skin glowed, flawless as a fresh coat of snow, not a single blemish or line, not even around her eyes or mouth. When she smiled, the whiteness of her teeth astounded. We often joked about her age, she along with the rest of us. She joined our household in October of 1847, only weeks prior to my birth. right after Miss Coughlin took leave due to health issues, explaining the arthritis in her hands had made the act of caring for a child unbearable. Miss Coughlin had been with the family through the birth of both Thornley and Matilda, and had been expected to stay another year or so, long enough for Ma and Pa to find a suitable replacement. Her early leave came at a very difficult time. Pa spent most of his hours at Dublin Castle due to the start of the famine, and Ma was in no condition to interview replacements, being only weeks away from my birth. Ellen appeared as if sent by God. Through word of mouth alone, she had heard about potential employment and arrived on our doorstep with nothing more than a small bag in her possession. She claimed to be 15 at the time, an orphan who had spent the past 5 years in a household looking after children of her providers, a boy and a girl, aged 5 and 6, only to lose the entire family to cholera the month before. The mother of the house had been a midwife, and Ellen explained she had aided her with dozens of deliveries. She would be willing to offer her service in exchange for lodging and a small stipend for a short period of time, at least until after my birth, while Ma had time to recuperate. Ma and Pa had no alternatives available to them, and they welcomed Ellen Crone into our home, where she immediately became indispensable. My birth in November of 1847 was a difficult one. I was born breech, the umbilical cord wrapped around my neck, at the hands of my father's cousin, a prominent Dublin doctor who believed I was stillborn since I did not utter a sound. Uncle Edward Alexander Stoker declared that no heartbeat was found beneath my blue skin, but Ellen insisted I was alive, snatched me from him, and went to work breathing for me, her lips on mine for nearly 3 minutes before I finally coughed and joined the world of the living. Ma and Pa were amazed, and Uncle Edward claimed that this was nothing short of a miracle. Ma later told me she was sure I was dead in the womb because I rarely kicked. As a mother of two, she had real experience to draw upon, and she felt certain. For that reason, she hadn't allowed Pa to settle upon a name. It wasn't until I was breathing and proven alive that she agreed to the name Abraham, my father's namesake, and took me into her arms for the first time. In later years, Ma told me Nana Ellen had looked worn and haggard that night, appearing as if she too had given birth, and that it had taken every ounce of her strength. The moment I was tucked safely at Ma's side, Ellen had retired to her room and did not emerge for nearly 2 days, much to the dismay of Pa, who spent hours at her door in an attempt to coax her out, as he needed help with both the children and Ma. For those 2 days, Nana Ellen went unseen. She finally emerged on the third day without a single word about the episode, and simply returned to her household duties. Pa would have sacked her had he had a replacement, but there was none. I think we'll stop there.
I was hoping for the full 500 pages, to be honest, but...
Let me tell you something, James. Audible and JD and I are over the moon on this. You know, they do these... They buy the rights to these books, and Audible has done a full cast reading of this. So
they've got six
actors, voice actors, and it's interesting, you know, you being a Yorkshireman, you know, you've got to get the accents right, especially when you're dealing with Eastern European, Irish, and obviously we've got this character Vambery who was the Van Helsing style. So there's a lot of subtleties, and they've done a very good job. I'm plugging the Audible because if you like to listen to books, that's fun. And if, of course, you like reading, there's nothing better for me than just curling up with the book and scaring the heck out of yourself. But, it's cool on Audible. And the film rights have been sold to Paramount, and JD and I are crossing our fingers. They've been in touch with us about who we think should adapt our novel and the screenplay and so on, and we're just hoping they do a good job with it if it ever comes to pass. Yeah.
That sounds great. Yeah. I guess you probably can't discuss it now, but you have someone in mind, or are you quite flexible on that one?
We're not, I wish I could, but we're not allowed to. It's an interesting world. It's very different than the writing world and the broadcasting world because it's very secretive, and there's a lot of, sort of private deals that go on. You know, it's so-and-so's a screenwriter, and he or she is hot with something, or she's a specialist in this. and just hit a home run with this other one, they want that person right away.
Of course.
It really doesn't, it doesn't matter what JD and I think. They bounced a couple of us things off of us, and we went and you know, you it's so nice nowadays. Someone says, "Oh, it's, you know, Bill Smith. What's he done? Oh, I'd like you to go look at this movie that he's done." So we'll sit back and, you know, on our computer and watch something and give some ideas. But what I'm really looking forward to is when they do choose somebody and they and we find out what input they, do they want from us on the adaptation. Most of the time, it's absolutely nothing. Other times, it okay, we've got to shorten this thing. We've got to do this, but we want to convey Bram just this way, or his sister. And let me tell you something. It's been about 8 years before I even started writing this story. You know, going back to the first book and the lectures I give, I've got to know these seven kids in the Stoker family, my great-grandfather being one of them. I've got to know them through their letters, their diaries, the journals I found, the obituaries people have written about them. I feel that I'm quite an expert on these people, and it would be a great disservice if you were trying to portray these people in a film if you didn't ask me what my opinion, and obviously that's all it is. They don't have to take it. But what JD and I wrote is very realistic about how these people act and react. Even in a fictional story, they're portrayed as being real.
I'm convinced they're real. I am.
But not the sparkly ones, for goodness sake. We're going to have vampires. We want the proper, you know, evil, blood-sucking, parasite, nasty, horrible ones, not sparkly. Goodness sake.
No, there's enough of those.
Too many.
This is true, but I can still daydream about, like, Angel, you know, from Buffy, because he was super hot. So I'm going to keep that fantasy alive. Now I'm thinking I need some garlic or you know, something to keep away the a cross. I don't know. Does that work?
It does.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the sacraments, the wafer. It's not a bad idea to keep those around. Especially, Christina, if you ever choose to head over to, you know, Transylvania, some of these cool spots. I actually lead tours over there from time to time when there's enough folks that want to see the places. But, you know, in a funny way, you know, you get that there are some vampire stories. As a matter of fact, in 2004, there was an exhumation in sort of the mountainous regions, the very isolated regions of Romania. People to this day believe that this young girl, that her uncle died, and she was ill not long after he was buried. And so the townsfolks, with the permission of the wife of the guy that died, didn't get permission from the church. That's caused a problem. But they went in the middle of the night with their torches and their stakes, and they cut open the guy's chest, and they took the heart out and brought it to a crossroads where burned it and created this kind of ashen porridge and brought it back to the young lady who had little kids and she was sickly, and they fed her this horrible, you know, mess of charred remains of her uncle's heart, and she recovered. For whatever reason, she recovered.
Wow.
Maybe the power of suggestion. And then, of course, all hell broke loose because the authorities and the, you know, embarrassed, and the church embarrassed, and the police were looking for this guy. But he was actually featured in a segment of a pretty cool show on PBS called Secrets of the Dead, and I was on the same segment with this guy that they found. But it took them about 2 years to find the guy because he was in hiding. But this stuff, you know, people still believe in certain parts. Heck, I've been in New Orleans. And mm-hmm. you know, in a voluntary way, people do blood exchanges, and that's you know, it's not that I partake myself, but if it makes them feel better, it's all voluntary. Big deal, they do it. So it's cool.
Yeah.
I met some of them. Yeah.
Yeah, I was went to New Orleans a couple of years ago, and there's a whole sort of underground. They use the word loosely, vampire movement. Well, you say that they have givers and takers, and they have young people, it's their whole lifestyle. They will sleep in coffins, and they do. They they will cut, do some regulated cutting and drink the blood. And, you know, it is a whole lifestyle for them, which is kind of, that's what I was going to say, weird, but it's different. like you say, yeah, baby, you know, if it's not hurting anyone, then go for it. Why not?
Yeah, it's tough to be judgmental. I mean, especially nowadays, there's a lot of things we should all be open-minded about, and especially if there's no real victims. You know, they go and get their blood tested to make sure there's no diseases being passed on, and it's voluntary, and that's their thing. That's, you know, I go out and do crazy things in sports, you know, to the point where, you know, I abuse my body and have to get my hips replaced because I play far too much real tennis, you know, things like that. People think are as crazy as doing a blood exchange, but that's what I like to do.
Yeah, you're right. There are probably crazier things that people do.
Yeah.
Well, you know, not many people know this about ex-Tina, but I have, well, actually when I was 19, I think it was 18 or 19, I got a tattoo on my neck of vampire bites. And,
cool,
yeah,
really?
Yeah.
You still have that?
You know,
you still have it, or do you have it removed?
I have it removed, but the cool thing is that now it actually looks like a scar, like it's real. Because, you know, it was this big tattoo shop that was opening up, and, you know, it was a spur of the moment thing. And after it was done, I was like, it doesn't look right. It kind of looked like it was a buck tooth vampire, you know, so I had to remove it. Now it looks I just have a scar. So it kind of looks like what I wanted it to look like when I got it done. So
what was, I've got to ask you this, it couldn't have been just spur of the moment. There had to be a friend involved or friends who were into Buffy or vampires.
Or
a number of adult beverages involved. So give us the backstory. You can't get away that easily.
No, there was no alcohol involved. None at all. I was just and I can't even say it was ever like goth or anything, but I definitely was into vampires. So it was the time back then with like the Lost Boys and stuff, and I was like completely in love with Chris Sutherland and of course the bad vampire, the bad guy. So I don't know. And my mom begged me, she said, please don't get anything else, anything you want, you know, and, I wanted vampire bites, but when I was 18 years old, I got a tattoo of Alice Cooper on my arm. So, you know, I was a rebel back then, I guess. So Alice Cooper.
I think spur of the moment tattoos, never a good idea, listeners. Don't. Give it some thought, please.
Did it hurt on your neck? I mean, I've always heard, I don't have one on my body. I'm too much of a weenie to go into to inflict that much pain. I've heard they can be pretty painful.
I don't know. I think that out of all that, I have quite a number of tattoos. I'm not going to say how many on the show. It's not like I have sleeves or anything like that, but you know, a lot of mine are really small ones. But no, I have like some on my hands, and those were definitely the worst.
Right,
you know, because
right.
It's really bony
well,
there.
I have to say, Xena, I have all of those beat. But it's a family show.
I do.
I can beat any horror tattoo story, hands down.
You can. I just remembered that. Yeah, this is a family show, but you know, it is rated R, so there is that. Yeah,
but
if
people always say, "Oh, my tattoo on my ankle hurt," and that, well, you try having one where I had one, and seriously,
and,
just
you know. I have the stars that I have on my head, like tattoos on my, you know, this on my like down to I don't know, like under close to my eye area, and that was, you know, people are like, oh my gosh, that must have really hurt, but you know what, it really didn't. I mean, after a while, it was just like it wasn't bad at all. The next day I did have a headache for like, you know, the entire day, so
the vibration probably just rattled your head around for a little bit, you know, because those things they do rattle you.
You know, I want to say it has been such an awesome show. We definitely have to have you come back. You know, normally we take a break in the halfway part, but this time we're like, no, we're just going to keep going because this is awesome. So, and you know, James was saying he wanted a book, and I have to say, I'm going to put my vote in for a book as well. this was so much fun. Yeah. So you have
well, you
to
can contact me on Facebook. You guys know how to do that, and then. Because
yeah.
I do actually keep books at home that I do sign and can ship out. I don't think I've got a very busy fall schedule. The paperback comes out in October, and I'm traveling. I'm actually going to be in Ireland and in Great Yarmouth, actually, and in
Great Yarmouth.
Yeah. So there's a number of events I'll be doing, but nothing in Texas. So I might have to use the U.S. Postal Service to send you a book your way, James. And, Xtina, I don't think I've got a fly fishing trip up in Bristol, but may have to send one up that way to you.
Oh, that'll be great.
So we'll be in touch. But thank you guys all very much for having me. It's been great fun. Lots of good back and forth. And, contact me again in a number of months when there's more action to report.
Yeah,
I
that's
definitely
fantastic.
Will.
Fantastic.
There,
and it has been an honor, Dacre. Thank you so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate that.
Very welcome. You guys have a nice evening, whatever's left
thank
of it.
I think straight to bed for me. So.
Okay.
So you have a great rest of your evening. Thanks a lot.
Great. Good.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you
soon. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Well, that flew by. Again, 90 minutes has just gone. So, it is that time where we have to say goodnight, Xtina.
Goodnight, Xtina.
Crash of